Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We are also pleased to have back here on the program once again David Sinnoh. He is clinical professor of finance in the U of I College of Business. And once a month, always on a Friday, he is here to talk about financial planning. And he begins by making a few comments, sometimes about some specific planning topic, sometimes just a kind of general comment about where we are here with the economy. And if you have questions on his opening remarks or anything else that has to do with money management, call us, give us your question. He will see if he can help you out. So with that, we say welcome back. Glad to have you here.
Well, good morning, David. And of course, as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. I thought I'd take just a few minutes to discuss, well, some difficult rules considering IRAs. And that being, if you are a beneficiary of an IRA, and you actually now are the recipient of those funds, my goodness, there are a myriad of choices. And what should I do? What are some of the best choices with respect to being an IRA beneficiary? And there continues to be just tremendous confusion about the choices you have if you're a beneficiary and the original account holder has now passed away. Well, let's take, first of all, the example of a traditional IRA. Now, that's the old-fashioned IRA, where people put money into an IRA program and they took a tax deduction for it, and all of the money, presumably, was growing tax-deferred. No taxes had ever been paid on the money. Well, let's assume that your spouse has now passed away and you are the beneficiary of that traditional IRA. What choices do you have? The first choice is you can just grab the money, take the money, spend it, give it away, etc. Now, if you take the money, there is no penalty. That's important to understand. No penalty on taking the money, but the money must be reported on your federal income tax return. And that money, of course, could leverage you into a higher tax bracket, maybe 25%, 28, 33, 35. It depends. So if you simply say, gee, I need the money, I'm going to pay off some old bills, some expenses, maybe a mortgage, keep in mind that all of that money would be subject to being reported and you've got to pay tax on it, maybe 25%, something like that. That's simply an option that any spouse has. A second option is saying, well, I really want to continue to defer that money. So as a result, I think I will transfer it either into my own IRA or I'll set up a new one called a spousal IRA. So we have those two choices, and that is a trustee-to-trustee tax-free transfer. And essentially, that money then would continue to grow tax-deferred in the spouse's IRA account. Now, when that spouse reaches 70 and a half, for example, he or she has to start distributing that money. And when that spouse reaches at least 59 and a half, then that spouse can take money out of that IRA with no penalty. But again, because all of that money is tax deferred money, when you start accessing it, when you start taking it out, you've got to report it on your federal income tax return. Now, interestingly enough, in the state of Illinois, and this is just in the state of Illinois, there are different rules in other states, when we take distributions from our IRAs, when we're retired, we don't pay state income taxes on any of that money. Similarly, when we have pension distributions in the state of Illinois, we typically don't have to pay state income tax on that money. Now, there is a third choice, but it's a little bit more convoluted, and you really need to discuss it with your tax advisor or your financial planner, and that is that you could actually transfer the assets into something called an inherited IRA, and that's held in the name of the original spouse, but it is held for your benefit. And essentially, it provides you with a little bit more flexibility, but I really don't want to spend a lot of time talking about that particular rule because really, when it comes to a spouse is either going to take the money or roll it into her own IRA program. Now, that's with a tax-deferred or traditional IRA. Many people today, of course, have a Roth IRA program. And I generally recommend in my classes, if you are eligible to establish a Roth IRA, it means you have earned income. It typically means that you fall below the income restraints, which are a little bit over $100,000. You can essentially fund your own Roth IRA. You're doing it with after-tax money. So presumably, that money then grows tax-free. And when you're old and gray like myself, and you take the money out, then presumably you are taking it out on a tax-free basis. At least that's the current federal law. Well, what happens if along the way, for example, your spouse passes away and you are now the beneficiary of your former spouse's Roth IRA? Again, you could access all of the money. You could take it all out. And as long as that Roth IRA was at least 5 years old, when you took the money out, you could just take it all out, spend it, and no tax impact because, after all, the original contributions were after-tax contributions. An alternative is to essentially transfer the assets to your own Roth IRA. So again, you could establish your own Roth IRA, transfer it if you didn't have one. If you've already got one, you can pour that money in to your own Roth IRA. And now you decide who the beneficiaries are down the road. And again, the Roth IRA has to be around 5 years before you can access it. Otherwise, there are some small tax consequences. But essentially, those are two very, very good choices. And a third choice is to do something called a Roth inherited IRA, but a bit more complicated. And I really don't want to go into that unless someone really is interested in hearing about it. Now, something I would like to discuss, and that is that sometimes with a traditional IRA and often with a Roth IRA, what happens if the primary beneficiary, let's say mom and dad or grandma and grandpa, grandpa has a IRA, grandma is the primary beneficiary, but she predeceases her husband, and now the contingent or the secondary beneficiaries are a trust. That's not unusual. There may be a trust as a beneficiary, and that trust really says, well, within my trust, I have 5 nieces and nephews or 10 nieces and nephews, and they're all going to be beneficiaries of my trust. So now it gets a lot more complicated. And in many cases, because of the complication, the easiest thing to do is to say, okay, the trust is the beneficiary, but within the trust, there are 8 or 9, 10, 11 nieces and nephews who are going to receive this money. Let's just go ahead and distribute it to all of those ultimate beneficiaries, and let's just wrap the whole thing up. They'll pay tax on the money, no penalty, but whatever they receive, if it was in a tax-deferred or traditional IRA, and they receive 1/10 of it, 1/5 of it, 1/8 of it, whatever, they'll report that on their own individual tax return and pay tax on it. And indeed, that happens very, very often. Similarly, if it's a Roth IRA, same rules. If we've got a Roth that's been around 5 years, we've got lots and lots of beneficiaries of a trust, just distribute the money, and then as a result, there is no tax because it was a Roth IRA program. However, there is another choice, and this is called an inherited IRA. In other words, what really happens here is the trust, not the beneficiaries, the trust sets up an account called an inherited IRA. And at that point in time, then the trust goes to all the beneficiaries, figures out who the oldest beneficiary is, and typically what happens is that money then can be distributed to all of those beneficiaries over the remaining lifetime of the oldest beneficiary. So you take a youngster like you, Dave, in your 30s, take an old guy like me in the 60s, and we happen to be the beneficiary of somebody's IRA. Don't ask me how, but it happens, and it comes through a trust. Well, if we set up an inherited IRA, or the trustee sets up an inherited IRA, our distributions would be based upon my life because I'm older than you are. So it's a bit complicated. And if you have an IRA program where the secondary beneficiary is a trust, I would urge you to talk to your financial advisor or your estate planner who set that up for you and make certain that you understand the impact of those choices. Well, okay, it's no secret. It's been a very, very volatile year on the U.S. and the European stock markets. Hey, we all know that. And we see the markets go up 2% one day, they go down 2% the next day, etc. And people really are frightened. People are really in a tizzy. People are pulling out of the stock market. They are reducing their asset allocation way, way back on stocks. And what are they doing? They're putting their money in money market funds, savings accounts, which basically is earning no interest. Some people are jumping out, even buying 10-year treasuries. That's paying a whopping 2% at the current time. It's tough to tie your money up for 2%, and that's the $64 question. Well, in spite of all of the volatility, let's kind of re-examine what's happened since January 1. We could look at our couch potato portfolio, which was just updated this morning by Harriet Williamson on the WILL website. And our couch potato portfolio, I can't get very excited about this, but through last night's close, it's down a little over 6% for the year. Again, nobody likes to be down 6%, but that's a 100% equity portfolio through all the ups and downs, the terrible stories from Greece and Italy and the other European problems that are out there. The bottom line is that a diversified portfolio is down about 6% this year. It could be a lot worse. And in fact, if we hadn't had a couple of downdraft days over this past week, that portfolio would only be down about 2% for the year. Now, interestingly enough, our benchmark, which is the S&P 500 index, it's only down about 1.5% for the year. So if you put your money in the S&P 500, you're only down about 1.5% for the year. Why is the couch potato portfolio down significantly more? Because we have 30% exposure to Europe and emerging markets, and they have been hammered, so to speak, as compared to the U.S. markets. So again, international diversification, at least through the first, what, almost 10.5 months of the year, why it hasn't paid off. And if you are going to continue to dollar cost average into a portfolio, my advice would likely be at the moment we're probably not going to see a lot of improvement in the short run in Europe. And so you might considering, oh, if you're going to dollar cost average a little bit less into the European index and maybe repositioning more of that into the U.S. market indexes or perhaps the emerging market. And even though the emerging market has been hammered as well, I still think that has a lot of future opportunity. So bottom line, don't be frightened. It's natural. And when people are frightened, they react. They make moves out of fear. I don't think that makes sense. And remember, if you're only 30 or 40% of your portfolio is in stocks and you're down 5% for the year or 6%, 40% of 6% is 2.4%. So overall, it is not disastrous. It's not pleasant. But nevertheless, it is not disastrous. And I would urge caution, stay steady, don't get hung up in watching the day-to-day volatility and market moves on the U.S. stock market. So there's a little bit about IRAs, a little bit about Roth IRAs. Talk to your estate planner, talk to your tax planner about, am I set up correctly in terms of beneficiary designations? And steady goes the ship in those high waves in the U.S. and global stock markets.
Okay. David Sinnoh is the guest. He's here on the program once a month. It is always on a Friday. He's clinical professor of finance in the U of I College of Business. And if you have questions on what he has just discussed or anything else that has to do with money management, financial planning, he's going to do his best to help you out. Take the opportunity of getting some of his advice. 333-9455. toll-free 800-222-9455. You can also send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. I was just looking, in fact, looking over, you had it sitting in front of you upside down, but I was just looking at the couch potato portfolio and indeed noticing that as you have your dollar split up, the most money, 27 cents of every dollar, is going into this total international index. And I'm wondering now, okay, we're coming near to the end of year, and I think you've always counseled that at least once a year you want to look at your asset allocations and think, do we want to continue this? So are you thinking about taking money out of the international and putting it, splitting it up amongst the U.S.?
Well, interestingly enough, when you rebalance the portfolio, and usually I wait to rebalance until the first week of January, and the reason I do that is because if you are in an after-tax portfolio and you rebalance, you could actually trigger some capital gains. Now, if you have capital losses, it really doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. But if you trigger capital gains, that would add some pain. In other words, what? My portfolio is down for the year, and you're telling me that I owe some tax on capital gains. So as a result, I generally would wait until January. Now, if you are reallocating inside a tax-deferred instrument like an IRA, a retirement plan, then it really doesn't matter, and you could allocate. Now, theory would tell you that you look at your overall portfolio, and my percentages are, for example, 27% in the total international index. And indeed, if that international index has gone down, and it has during the year, maybe we only have 22 or 23% exposure. So what theory would tell you to do, which seems to be counterintuitive, is you would actually increase your position. Mm-hmm. And as hard as that is, that's probably what I would recommend unless I change my overall asset allocation of the model. Mm-hmm. And in December, in the December show, I will talk about, have I made any actual structural changes to the asset allocation of the model. But if I don't, I'm going to follow the will. I'm going to step right in front of that giant wave and say, no, I'm supposed to have 27%. I'm down to 22. I need to reallocate in that portfolio. Mm-hmm. You know, and one of the questions that comes up, David, which is interesting, is how does this European crisis really impact me? Okay, stuff is going over in Italy and people are coming and going and politicians are coming and going. And we know that there is all of this sovereign debt and they're talking about writing it down. How does this really impact me? Okay, well, in a variety of ways, it impacts you and I. First of all, it is estimated, and this is quite interesting, that approximately $700 billion of European sovereign debt, and a whole lot of that is Italy, a whole lot of it is Greece, and a whole lot of it is Portugal, Spain, France, etc. About $700 billion of sovereign debt is held by U.S. and U.S.-related financial institutions. We already know it's very likely that with respect to Greek sovereign debt, that's going to be written down about 50%. How do you like that, David? We have a debt, and we don't want to pay it, so I guess, well, you're going to accept 50 cents on the dollar instead of a dollar. I guess if you're a country like Greece, you can do that. Well, that's going to hit U.S. banks pretty darn hard. Mm-hmm. If we've got $700 billion, which I guess would be a little bit more than 5% of our GDP annually, all right, and banks suddenly take a haircut, then their capital is impacted. So they have to reserve more for loan losses. They have to build up capital. What that really means is that it becomes harder for small businesses to borrow money from banks, which makes it harder for small businesses to hire people and get employment going. That's just one example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, one of the big business stories that has we've seen in the last month or so was one big investment company that was heavily invested in sovereign debt of countries that were in trouble was destroyed because of it.
MF Global.
Yes, and that was, and it seemed that that the man who was running it, Mr. Corzine, actually had this deliberate strategy. He, you know, other people would have been running from that. He said, oh, no, this is great. We'll buy this stuff up cheap. It's going to be great. Sooner or later, they're going to bounce back. And he was way over leveraged and they were in terrible shape. And so the whole thing fell
apart.
So you have to wonder, well, how many other people are there that are holding this kind of paper and they're going to be big losses.
Big losses. And I want to come back to the MF Global situation because I have a piece of advice for anybody who is in stocks. So we'll come back to
that.
Well,
I tell you what, we do have a caller. Okay. We'll get to them. Others are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. You can shoot us an email if you'd like. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. And we have a caller right here in Urbana. Line one. Hello.
Hi there.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi. I always enjoy both of you on the radio. I have a question. What do you say to all the people who are very doom and gloom and feel like the economies of the world and the United States and Europe in particular are so volatile and so unstable and so unsupported that normal, conventional, historically sound investments are not, and that you should buy gold and silver? And I'm going to hang up and listen.
Okay,
and we hear a lot of that. And I think what we have found historically that we have been through very, very difficult periods. We can look back to 73, 74. We can look to the 87 very debilitating bear markets. We can look to the 90 bear markets where we had tremendous economic upheavals. Things are cyclical. Things are cyclical. And economies ultimately expand. Now, in the short run, it's very, very difficult to ride these things out, especially when we don't have good alternative investments. It's a very tough situation where we have stocks either just treading water or being negative, and we can't place our money in fixed income instruments drawing maybe 3, 5, 6, 7%. And that is likely to continue for some time because our federal government just can't afford to see interest rates move up because we can hardly afford the interest on our national debt as it exists currently. But I would say this. I would say that economies are cyclical. We're in a negative cyclical time. This is not something new. We have seen this before. There will be a recovery. And in addition to that, in terms of investing in alternative investments like commodities, like gold, like silver, that's okay, but you have to be very, very careful. Maybe somewhere between 2 and 4% of your overall portfolio. It's more of a hedge than actually a substantial investment strategy. In terms of an investment strategy, you'd be up against the traders, the private equity firms, the computer traders, and you would be bound to fail. 9 out of every 10 utilizing that kind of strategy will fail unless they simply take a position and hold it as a hedge. So a 2 to 4% position in a gold mutual fund, in a GLD index, for example, I'm not going to quibble. I'm not going to fight that, but certainly no more than that.
All right. Very good. Next caller is in Montgomery County, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I don't really understand the whole basics of everything you're talking about, and I probably represent a lot of us. But speaking as an ex-factory worker who spent his money and bought land, isn't all stock market stuff dependent on exploiting somebody's labor somewhere along the lines? I mean, you're not going to make a profit unless you can work somebody as cheaply as possible, right?
Well, I'm not certain that's the case. I mean, we can look at tremendous numbers of very successful firms like the technology firms, and that's really based upon information, communication, and technology, and less on individual labor. So individual labor, unfortunately, is being expropriated to foreign countries where you're absolutely right. There's a labor arbitrage. It's much cheaper to employ people over there, and I really don't see that trend changing very, very much. So the stock market, on the other hand, is based upon every stock, theoretically, is based upon looking out to the future and trying to figure out what kind of earnings or what kind of income that company is going to have, and then taking that earnings stream and what's called discounting it back to today, and then saying that is the real value of a company divided by the number of shares, and that sort of gives you the value of a company. So that's really how stocks are basically valued. People can disagree about future earnings, discount rates all day long, but basically there's a model, and that's kind of a basic model of how stocks are valued. It is true that one of the major inputs into any business is labor, but actually labor is becoming less important, and other factors are becoming more important. So it's a problem for the labor force overall. That's the real difficulty. And what's happening is that while there are jobs available in this country, the jobs are going unfilled because they are requiring certain kinds of educational skills that most of us don't have. So it's a very difficult situation, a tough situation to solve.
Okay, but if we hadn't bailed out with our tax dollars, Lehman Brothers and all these other bloodsuckers, wouldn't stocks be cheaper and then I could buy stocks at a cheaper price? I mean, people talk about the market, this and that. Where does the market come in when somebody takes my taxes and gives it to Lehman Brothers? That doesn't sound like a market-based economy to me.
Well, again, with respect to Lehman Brothers, actually no one did give the money to Lehman Brothers. And unfortunately, Lehman Brothers, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, they actually failed. So
okay,
that was
you
a case of
I mean,
actually,
right?
but I understand what you mean, and I'm not disagreeing that you're bringing up huge policy questions, and that's really better spoken with an economist, and that is to say that should we be bailing out? I think that's what you're getting to. Should we be bailing out these mega companies who essentially had a lot to do with this economic crisis in the first place? Is that what you're really asking?
Well, yeah, because you're talking about people act like the invisible hand of the market's at play, and it's hard to see that when somebody puts a gun to my head, says, I'm going to take your taxes and give it to this rich fat cat. How is the invisible hand of the market anywhere? You spoke of commodities. I can give you a web address. You can go to see how much tax dollars go to these tractor trash welfare farmers.
Okay, well, again, I mean, you're asking difficult questions. I sympathize with you, but I'm really not in a position to answer those kinds of questions.
I'm going to jump in. I appreciate the comments of the caller. Not that they're inappropriate, but they're a little bit beyond the scope of what we can do with this particular program, where we're trying at least to give people a chance to ask kind of nuts and bolts questions about, okay, given the realities that we have, we may not be happy about them, but we have them. What do we do in terms of our personal decisions? That's what we're trying to help with. We do have some other callers here. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. You can send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Next is someone in Lexington. This is line number two. Hello.
Thanks a lot for the show.
Sure.
You tripped my trigger when you were bringing up the comments about, I wasn't going to call about MF Global, but I'm kind of one of the victims of that as a farmer. I kind of wanted to hear what you had to say, but I had another question along those lines. I use a SEP plan in a self-employment pension.
Correct,
and,
sure.
It's always bothered me that the limitations of that pension plan is to, you know, financial instruments. And as a farmer, I've always felt that, you know, it should be my land that I buy and use is most of my retirement income, although I have a sizable amount in a SEP plan and what you build up over the years. Is there any reason not to? And I know there are rules about that, but farm real estate has been a way better investment than the stock market has been for the last several years.
It certainly has, and we could talk about the price of land ad infinitum, but that's maybe another day or another question. Whether you have a SEP plan, an IRA plan, a retirement plan, one of the requirements is to be able to have a plan that has a discernible fair market value at the end of the year and is liquid. And unfortunately, farmland as an investment just doesn't fit in that it can be valued on any given day. Also, you really can't buy anything in your retirement plan which you are farming or land directly. Those are just happen to be the rules. So, in other words, you're really limited to what are called liquid securities. Now, one choice that you would have is that there are real estate investment trusts. They're called REITs. These are stocks that trade on exchanges. They are perfectly liquid. And there are REITs, for example, that invest just in land. So you may Google, for example, REITs investing in farmland. Take a look at those, and that may be a way for you to essentially get involved with funds in your SEP and sort of kill two birds with one stone. So
yeah,
that might be a possibility.
You haven't recommended REITs very often. I know that.
Well, actually, they actually are in my portfolio. So
okay.
They are in my portfolio. As a matter of fact, I have REIT exposure in my portfolio essentially of about 7%. So 7 cents of every dollar are in a REIT portfolio. And I happen to use the Vanguard REIT Index, which is just really an index of lots and lots of REITs. But that may be an alternative for you.
All right. Well, thank you. And any comments on MF Global? Because that situation has, we used to have the full faith and confidence and trust had been broken with the CME and the CBOT. That is shaken everybody, how we trade commodities and everything. This is a big effect. You could do a whole show on that. So
well, thank
we you
could.
Very much. I'll take up your time.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
I tell you what, we also need to make a break here real quick. When we come back, you can respond to that comment by the caller. We're talking this morning about money management, something that we do once a month on the show with David Sinnoh. We'll continue after a short break. This is Focus.
WILL programs are made possible by Bevere Cafe. Bevere Cafe serves breakfast and lunch from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Monday through Friday and an after hour till 2:30 p.m. featuring soups, sandwiches, salads, ice cream, and specialty coffees. Bevere offers Wi-Fi. Daily menus are available online at bevercafe.illinois.edu.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We have 10 shows, 10 different topics for you every week. In the second hour today, we will open things up so you can ask questions about medicines that you might be taking. And our guest will be Dr. James Rybacki. He is a doctor of pharmacy and has been on the program before to talk about this very topic, how to get the most out of medicines that you're taking. And one thing in particular, we'll be talking about some of the news coming out of the recent scientific meeting of the American Heart Association. They have one big meeting every year. All the researchers get together and talk about the various drug trials and work that they're doing to try to prevent heart disease, work with people who have had one heart attack so they don't have another one. We'll talk about what's new. And then Monday at 10 o'clock, another of our regulars will be here. That's Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. This is a program we do once a month to help you out with home maintenance problems. So if something needs to be fixed, you can give us a call. You can check the schedule of future programs by going to the website. It's WILL.illinois.edu. In this hour of Focus, our guest is David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at the U of I. Once a month on a Friday, he's here and we talk about money management and personal finance. So you were ready to say some things about MF Global.
Well, I was going to give an example, and this has something to do with MF Global. But let's start with a typical person who has a brokerage account. Maybe it's at a Schwab. Maybe it's at Ameritrade. Maybe it's at some other brokerage firm. And most of us can figure out, all right, I'm going to put some money in my brokerage account, and then I'm going to buy a security. Well, when you sign the brokerage account paperwork, interestingly enough, what they really don't tell you, unless you really read the fine print very, very carefully, is that a brokerage firm has the right, get a load of this, to borrow your securities out of your account. Even though when you get your monthly statement, it says, I've got 1,000 shares of IBM or 2 shares of ABC. The truth of the matter is that the brokerage firm has the right to borrow the securities out of your account so someone else can what is called short those securities or sell those securities, and then thinking, gee, they're at a very high price. I'm going to sell those securities. So I'm going to borrow them out of someone's account, sell them, and then presumably they're going to go down in value, and I'll be able to buy them back at a lower price, replace them in someone's account, but I'll be entitled to the profit, the difference between that very high price I sold and the very low price I bought, as opposed to saying I'm going to buy something, hold it, watch it go up, and then sell it. So unless you request and sign a special form saying, no, 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 you can't do that, you can't borrow securities out of my account, then for 99% of America, securities can be borrowed out of an account. Mm. All right. Now, if you sign that form and then they borrow the securities out of your account, that's criminal. All right? That's somebody going to jail. But in the case of MF Global, guess what? All of these securities, and apparently, and no one is clear, and I am not clear, but allegedly, it looks like what happened is that a whole lot of people had their securities borrowed out of their account, and that money was then somehow utilized to take bets on sovereign debt. That seems to be what happened. And it's not clear whether or not that was lawful to do that or whether that was industry practice, and that's what seems to be being examined. Bottom line is if you have a position and someone else at a brokerage firm, at a clearinghouse is holding that position, you sign paperwork that says nobody can touch my securities. Nobody can borrow them out. Nobody can do anything. I live and die and breathe with those securities. So you then have eliminated that problem, and then if it happens, then we're talking about criminal fraud, and we're talking about someone going to jail, and that would be unpleasant.
All right. Well, we have several callers. I have a couple of emails here. Let me try to do one of the emails because it goes back to some of the things you were discussing earlier about IRAs. And we have someone who says, I have a Roth, have had a Roth IRA for several years. My income is now over the threshold for new deposits. Is the income threshold the same for regular IRAs? Can I have both a Roth and a regular IRA at the same time? What other tax-advantaged retirements are available for me if my income is too high for a Roth?
Well, those are a lot of questions. Number one, if your income is too high, you cannot contribute to a Roth. That's okay. The bottom line. All right. All right? And those income, it depends on whether you're single or married, but it's in the low $100,000. I could look them up if someone really wanted to know. But you can look them up by Googling Roth IRA income limitations. Very, very easy to look those up. Number two, could I open up a different kind of IRA and a traditional IRA? And that depends. If you are participating in an employer-sponsored plan, the answer is probably not. Probably not. So if you're working for someone else and with the kind of money that you are earning, the answer is no, I couldn't open a traditional IRA. But there is a third animal called a non-deductible IRA. And there's a little loophole in the law that Congress hasn't closed yet, but they're thinking of closing it. And that is I can open up a non-deductible IRA, typically with up to $5,000 of earned income. This person seems to have that. And I open a non-deductible IRA on day one. It's now established. And on day two, I do a trustee-to-trustee transfer to a Roth IRA. And oh my, I've now gotten around the rules, and I've actually established a $5,000 Roth IRA. So that's how you do it. Literally hundreds of thousands of people do this. And so Congress is aware of it. The IRS is aware of it. They're not very happy about it. But it is out there. You would need to contact your tax advisor, financial planner, to take that appropriate step.
Okay. Well, hopefully that helps. Let us, I think, go back to the phones here. Someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. I have a couple of questions. I currently have a few thousand dollars in a high-interest online savings account, and it's just sort of sitting there. I am not really using it for anything. Would I be better to open up a Roth IRA with this money? And then my second question is, I'm currently working a 1099 commission-based job. I heard from some people that I have to file my taxes independently on a quarterly basis. Otherwise, I could end up paying a penalty with the IRS if I wait till the end of the year.
Correct.
Can you elaborate a little bit on this and maybe tell me how I do that?
All right. If you have what is called 1099 income, then you're not an employee. You are self-employed. And if you are self-employed, you pay federal income tax, you pay state income tax, and oh my, you get to pay Social Security and Medicare tax, not once, but twice. So you're typically, when you are an employee, your Social Security tax rate, payroll tax rate in 2011 for an individual actually is 4.2%. Okay? So 4.2% if you were an employee, but you're both the employer and the employee because you're self-employed. So 8.4% of your earnings are going to go to Social Security on the first about $107,000 of earnings. Okay? So if you have less than $107,000 of earnings, you need to put aside 8.4%. In addition, you've got to support old people in America. Those are the Medicare recipients. And as an employee, you would pay a 1.45% payroll tax, but you're both the employer and the employee, so you've got to pay 2.9. So right away, out of your earnings, my simple math tells me that's 11.3%. So 11.3% of your profit, which means your income after your expenses, about 11% is going to go for Medicare and Social Security tax. In addition, you're going to have to pay federal income tax on your earnings. And again, you could look those up and kind of estimate what those would be. So really what makes best sense is to be withholding or essentially sending in a quarterly estimated payment. You can go to irs.gov and you can download estimated quarterly forms. They're not very difficult. You put your name on them, your Social Security number on them, and you send in 1/4 of your estimated federal income tax, which is going to include federal income tax, Social Security, and Medicare tax. Are you with me so far?
Yeah.
Okay. So you need to do that. That would be a smart thing to do. So okay. If you haven't paid enough in by the end of the year, you will get a penalty. Similarly, while you don't pay any payroll taxes to the state of Illinois, are you employed in Illinois?
Yes.
All right. You're going to owe state of Illinois income tax. And likewise, you should pay quarterly estimateds. So you can go to the state of Illinois website, just state of Illinois withholding tax forms. Just Google that. It'll show up and fill those out because the state of Illinois, who is broke, loves to assess penalties. And I've forgotten what those penalties are, but it's a very high rate. It's somewhere between, it's over 5%. So you don't want to be paying that. Now, with respect to your savings account, on the first $5,000 to $10,000, you may be earning 4 or 5% on that money. Is that what's happening?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a great rate.
Okay.
So I would leave that alone because you can't earn that. You might ask your bank or your savings and loan or wherever you're doing business, maybe your credit union, if I put that money in a Roth IRA, will you continue to pay me that rate? I think the answer is no. So in the short run, if you are earning a very, very high interest rate, which is almost a teaser rate on these savings accounts, it's probably a good place to warehouse money.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
All right. Very good. Let's go on to Champagne for another caller here. Line 3. Hello.
Yeah. Hi, David and David.
Hi.
Yeah, I've got a question about Europe. You've probably been studying the Europe situation probably lately, David.
Well, somewhat. I'm not an expert, believe me. I'm more of the financial planner, wealth manager.
Okay.
You probably want to talk to a European economist, but go ahead.
Can you calm somebody down who's just read Boomerang by Michael Lewis, the same author that wrote Moneyball?
Uh-huh.
And it's scary and humorous at the same time. It's because he goes to Iceland, Ireland, and Greece, and he doesn't even touch Italy or Spain. And last time I talked to my financial advisor, he was kind of not worried but concerned about the European market making all this volatility. And I think that's what scares everybody, besides the fact that we're not invited to these lunches in Manhattan with all these congressmen that are, you know, all these insiders. And I think there's an overwhelming sense of helplessness right now. You know, people try to do the right things and try to spread their money around. And also another question, if you have time to get to it, what do you think about variable annuities if you don't? And I've got one right now that's making 5 to 7% guaranteed, and there's tax advantages in that too.
And well, that's an unusual product where you have a variable annuity that is guaranteeing 5 to 7%, because a variable annuity, the underlying portfolio is typically securities, bonds, and stocks. So that's unusual to have a guarantee in a variable. It's not unusual to have a guarantee in a fixed annuity, but highly unusual in a variable.
That's what I got. And
okay. Are there penalties to pull it out?
Yeah, there is.
Okay, because if they're going to give you some kind of guaranteed rate, you can bet don't pull it out early, because they want to have the use of that money for a significant period of time. Of course, when you pull a variable annuity out, the earnings come out first. So it's last in, first out, sort of LIFO accounting, which means that you would pay ordinary income tax on the first monies that come out, and then the last monies that come out are your principal, which presumably was after-tax money, and that would not be subject to tax.
Because some of that is Roth IRA money that I converted over to that.
Oh, okay. Well, if you're in a Roth environment, then eventually when you pull it out, if you have done it correctly and you have a Roth IRA and you chose that investment, then that money would come out tax-free.
Okay.
Okay. You know, as far as Europe, Iceland, Ireland, Greece, you name the country, Norway, it's just going to be very, very tough to see what happens over there, whether or not those countries have the political will to deal with these economic issues. It's just going to be very, very tough to see.
I think, too, it's the culture and the culture of corruption over there, and people are just going to have to change the way they live.
Well, and they don't like that. It's pretty darn tough when you are a Greek citizen, and believe it or not, some Greek citizens have had a Social Security government benefit starting at 55, which is twice the highest Social Security benefit in the United States. And someone has been subsidizing that. That's called the Greek government selling bonds to people who are subsidizing those citizens, and that's going to change. And it already is changing.
That book is a really short read. It's really amazing. It'd be interesting if it wasn't so true. And it's just a real interesting book, I thought. I don't know if you read that or not lately.
I haven't read that particular book. The other interesting thing is that's very interesting to know is that most sovereign debt of Italy is held by Italian banks. Most sovereign debt of Greece is held by Greek banks. Most sovereign debt of France is held by French banks. And that makes sense because historically it was a very, very regional. And unlike the United States, you had banks of Bank of America, which was all over the country. So they would have debts from everywhere in the United States. But Europe was much more regional, much more nationalistic, etc. So the lion's share of this debt is actually held by the banks in these countries, and that's why there is so much pressure on the individual financial systems in these particular countries.
Mm-hmm. One thing real quick, I want to thank the caller. One thing real quick here, and I don't know how much you are up on rules for Social Security, but I did have an email from somebody here who was wondering. He says, I'll be 60 in January. I have two children, one 11 and one 8. If I retire at 62, what would the kids get
He says the website of Social Security says it would be between 150 and 180%, but doesn't say how this is determined. He also says I make about $55,000 a year.
Okay, you get a Social Security statement each year. If you retire at age 62, as opposed to waiting till your normal retirement date, I believe you would get a haircut. In other words, of what you would actually receive, I believe it is a 25% haircut. So let's assume that you are going to receive $1,500. Yes, and you took money at 62, then you would get 25% less. I don't usually recommend that anyone take money at 62 unless they are unemployed and they need that money. Your children don't receive anything so long as you are living. That's the important point. Your children, if they are minors under the age of 18 and you have died, then there is a family benefit, which might be approximately 180% of what you received. But let's hope that you are living, that you are not dead. Now, typically, people wait till normal retirement. And today, for most people who are about 62 today, normal retirement is 66. So you would be taking a haircut if you took your money at age 62, about 25%.
Okay. And again, real quick, someone wants to have some suggestions about books that they could read or classes they could take. They say, my husband has been doing all the financial planning and making the decisions. She says, I feel like it'd be good if she was educated. She would like to educate herself. You have something you might like to suggest?
Well, there are any number of great books out there on financial planning, etc. I think one of the greatest books to read, and two really good books, are The Millionaire Next Door. I think that's a great book because it tells you about the culture of accumulating money. And 99 out of every 100 Americans who are broke spend more than they make. And this breaks the culture of how do we actually spend less than we make, and how do we save more.
Okay.
I think it's one of the best reads that you can have from a cultural standpoint. There's 1,000 books to tell you how to invest money, but culturally, The Millionaire Next Door is a classic.
Okay, we got to go. Dave Sinnoh is a clinical professor of finance in the College of Business. We'll see you again next month. Thanks.
Thank you.